player. Listen, I love him.
It sounds like a great weekend.
Yeah.
It does.
It
wish we'd been out there.
Oh, I could have gone out, alcohol free, out. I'm off to limber up my index finger, Stuart. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Stuart Grant, event host of Sabutio World Cup.
Coming up on Five Live Breakfast, we're going to speak to Rachel Reeves as Labour begins its first conference as a party of government for 15 years.
And I've been speaking to Gloria Aldred, part of the team representing Mohammed Al-Fayed's victims.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
And the main news stories this morning, Rachel Reeves will use her first speech to a Labour conference as Chancellor to try to brighten the party's message after weeks of dire warnings about the state of the public finances. She'll promise a budget of real ambition with no return to austerity, but her speech could be overshadowed by questions about party donations and continuing discontent over the decision to scrap winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. Tom Hamilton is a former Labour policy adviser who's at the conference in Liverpool.
She's in a tricky position in the same way that the whole government is in a tricky position about the fact that, you know, they want to provide some hope. They want, just as importantly, to provide actual economic growth and a better economic situation than the country's had for the last several years. They've got that situation that they've inherited where, you know, we can have an argument about the winter fuel allowance. The reason why that decision was taken was precisely because of the hole that the country and that the public finances are in. So she's not in a position to sort of start handing out goodies, but she does have to say that things are going to get better.
The former Conservative Defence Secretary Sir Ben Wallace is facing questions about a change that was made to a draft bill that would have helped to shield the SAS from prosecution. Senior government sources have told the BBC's Panorama programme that before the bill was introduced to Parliament, Sir Ben was made aware of credible allegations that the elite Special Forces Regiment had killed detainees in Afghanistan. He's due to give evidence to the inquiry that's looking into the claims this morning.
BBC News has learned that police records of machetes, swords and so-called zombie knives have doubled over the past 5 years. 32 police forces across England and Wales released figures showing the large bladed weapons appeared in more than 14,000 crime logs last year. That's up from around 7,000 in 2019.
The final phase of the Post Office inquiry will begin today, looking at current practice and procedure at the business. The inquiry was set up after hundreds of sub-postmasters were wrongfully convicted of stealing money from branches based on evidence from the faulty Horizon IT system used by the Post Office.
And the Metropolitan Police has set out plans to try to rebuild trust with London's black communities, which it says have been let down over a number of years. The Race Action Plan includes a new stop and search charter, an overhaul of its policy on intimate searches on children, and measures to help black victims of crime. Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley says there remains a long way to go and there is a lot more work to do, but the plan is a step in the right direction. Katie Smith has all our sport today. Morning.
Morning, Rach. Morning, Claire. Mikel Arteta says he's proud of his Arsenal side, who were seconds away from a first win at Premier League champions Manchester City since 2015. Arsenal were leading 2-1 in the second half with 10 men. There were loads of incidents throughout this game, including Leandro Trossard getting sent off. And Arsenal defended resolutely until a 98th minute equaliser from John Stones. So it ended 2-2. City stay top of the Premier League table. Liverpool and Villa are pointing back and Arsenal sitting in fourth at the moment, 2 points off the early pace. Brighton drew 2-2 with Nottingham Forest. Both managers sent off late in that game, along with Forest player Morgan Gibbs-White. Celtic beat Falkirk 5-2 to set up a Scottish League Cup semi-final against Aberdeen. Motherwell will take on Rangers, the holders. And it was Arsenal-Manchester City, not just in the Premier League this weekend. It was a key fixture at the Emirates in the opening WSL round of fixtures. Viv Miedemar scored for City against her former club, so that one also ended 2-2. Lando Norris took victory in the Singapore Grand Prix, meaning McLaren's drivers only 52 points behind Max Verstappen now in the standings with 6 races to go. And Rory McIlroy says golf is testing him right now. He missed out on the PGA Championship title to Billy Horschel after it went to a second playoff hole.
Katie, thank you. You were mentioning, Rachel, that when women step out of your life, there's only certain things that they notice. Your daughter's at uni now and
yeah.
There's certain facial hair that she helps
there's
with.
One single hair that she monitors.
Hair,
and now
sorry.
She's gone. I'm aware of it, but you know, who's going to deal with it?
Well, and I said my other half, if I got a perm, I don't think he'd notice. Julian North Cotswolds. Morning, Julian's been in touch. Oh, Claire, your other half not noticing if you got a perm. My husband and I have been together for 10 years when out of the blue, he asked me if I had eyebrows. You could not make it up. Have I got eyebrows?
You'd think he'd notice if she...
Yeah.
didn't.
Yeah, you'd wonder. You would wonder. Julie, are you still with him? Anyway, I don't know.
Should you be?
Should you be? Matt Taylor's here with the weather.
Thank you very much, Claire. Very good morning to all. Not a great day out there for parts of England. Lots of surface water, lots of flooding around at the moment. Worst of the rain is in parts of the home counties, through towards Oxfordshire, parts of Gloucestershire, and southwards towards Hampshire. These are the areas probably see some of the worst of the rain today. We've got some downpours elsewhere across England, but one or two spots will stay dry. Wales, a few showers here and there. A few will just about stay dry too, but a lot of cloud to come. Scotland, North Ireland, fairly cloudy through the day. Best of any sunshine really will be towards the west of Scotland. Some rain in the far north of Scotland later in the day. Temperatures around 11 or 12 Celsius in the far north, up to 19 or 20 in East Anglia in the southeast.
And all is here with the travel.
I am. Lots going on. It's heavy rain, which has caused flooding. The M56 eastbound 12 at Runcorn is still closed because of an accident. M6 has two lanes closed. A shed load at Ashton in Makerfield, 24 heading north. M40, an accident just cleared. 13 Bishops, Tatchbrook rather. M1, all open now at Nottingham at Junction 27, Hucknall. M25, over the Dartford Crossing and the QE2 bridge. Clockwise queues taking you half an hour. M3 southbound, an accident in one lane at 3, Lightwater. M2, an accident in one lane at Chatham at Junction 3 westbound. M11, one lane closed at 7 at Harlow, and also queues on the A1M, an accident in one of the lanes at 3 St Albans northbound. Orna Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Good morning, welcome to 5 Live Breakfast this morning. Rachel Burden and Claire McDonald with you. We are looking ahead to the Labour Party conference today. We'll hear from Chancellor Rachel Reeves in the next hour. She's going to address the state of the economy ahead of her first budget announcement next month. Let's talk to Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Good morning.
Morning.
We have spoken about this £22 billion black hole that they have mentioned ever since they've been in power. So how does that affect public finances? How do you think she's going to set that out today?
Well, I don't suppose we'll get a great deal of detail today. That will wait for the budget on the 30th of October. I imagine that she will say no austerity. I think she will make sure she finds some way of making sure that spending isn't cut over the next few years. I imagine she'll say something about repeating what the Prime Minister said about those with the broader shoulders having to bear more of the burden. I think the real questions to which we want answers, which is what that's going to mean in terms of tax changes and what that's actually going to mean in terms of spending, we're going to have to wait. So I suspect we'll hear quite a lot of warm words, quite a lot of broad sense of direction, but maybe one or two specific policies, but not very much, is my guess.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously there's a vote today on the floor about from members of the party who are unhappy about changes to the winter fuel payment system. I mean, that essentially is going to generate some money, but how much money to plug this gap?
Well, really not very much. And I think it's an indication of how hard it is to make changes to public spending, because that's actually a very small change. And there'll be some, pensioners on limited incomes who will be badly affected by that. But the poorest are going to be protected. And obviously most, it's a small amount of their money. I think it's very striking that actually that was by no means the biggest thing that she announced back in July. She announced two other, I think, very big, much bigger changes. One was big cuts to road building and rail and infrastructure projects, which don't sit very well at all with her plan to increase growth. And the other, I think the biggest of all the changes actually, was to abandon, after an enormous amount of time, abandon plans for reforming the social care system. So I think this is indicative that there are some things which are difficult to do politically, and those are things which directly take money out of people's pockets, and other things which are actually rather worse for people, the social care plan, and worse for the economy. They're cutting the infrastructure spending, which actually seems to be politically very straightforward to do.
Yeah, I mean, and that's all part. I mean, she now has an attempt ahead of you that the Labour Party do to rebuild the NHS, to tackle what's going on in the prison service. And on that first point, you're saying, well, she's already kind of backed away from that one.
Well, on the social care front, certainly. I mean, the NHS itself is clear. I mean, we had the report a couple of weeks ago from Aradazi really setting out in fairly stark terms what a terrible state the NHS is in, but also making clear that that's despite the fact that there are, you know, many, many more doctors and nurses and so on than there were 5 years ago. But there's been an absolute collapse in productivity. Now, partly that seems to be down to years and years of underinvestment in the buildings and machinery and scanners and all of those sorts of things that you need to have a productive health service. Partly it seems to be to do with the way the organization is run at certain parts. Now, those are long-term and difficult things to turn around, which will need some money in terms of investment, but will also need, and I don't know how you do this, will also need really clear changes in leadership to change the way that it works.
I mean, if you're not going to, the party's election pledge was not to raise the rates of income tax, national insurance or VAT. So we've already had the changes to the winter fuel allowance. But what else is there? What do you think? I mean, we'll get the broad brush today, but I guess what everyone's going to be doing is kind of trying to read between the lines to see what she means about what's coming down the pipe next month, which will have a material impact on people. So where is her room for manoeuvre and who might that affect?
Well, the room for manoeuvre is pretty limited. I mean, it's worth saying, of course, there is still some big income tax rises coming in, which is this continuation of the last government's policy of freezing allowances and thresholds. That drags more and more of people's incomes into income tax. But beyond that, big money is really hard to get if you're not going to raise those big taxes. I mean, the easiest big money is by changing the way the pension contributions are taxed. I'm not saying it's a good idea, but you could get quite a lot of money from doing that. There's some money to get from reforming things like capital gains tax and inheritance tax, but you really do need to reform those, not just increase the rates. And the amount of money you get is pretty uncertain. So there are a lot of complicated things that you could do. There are one or two easier things, which I don't think are terribly good ideas, unless you're going to, as it were, break at least the spirit of the promise. I mean, if you remember, two or three years ago, the last Conservative budget, last Conservative government said in their manifesto, they said we're not going to raise national insurance contributions. But what they did was introduce an entirely new tax called the Health and Social Care Levy. Now, that was abolished quite soon after. But you could play with the words a bit and do something like that. That raises quite a lot of money without breaking the detailed word of the manifesto.
Borrowing, is that something they have committed? Have they ruled it out entirely? Or will they now say, you know, given the state we're in, this is something that's back on the table?
Well, there are changes they can make to very technical definitions of what they mean by debt and borrowing, which could actually give them a reasonable amount of additional room for manoeuvre. I mean, Rachel Reeves has absolutely firmly signed up to this idea that she's going to keep to the same rule, that debt should be falling in 5 years' time. But there are, as it turns out, quite different ways of defining what you mean by debt. And I think we might well in the budget see some changes to that. Now, that doesn't change anything real, of course, but in terms of the specificity of her fiscal rules, it could actually give her quite a lot of room for manoeuvre. And I don't think the markets would go too mad if she were to do something along those lines.
I mean, last week, Paul, we heard the consumer confidence index had fallen. So people hanging on to their money a little bit more because they're uncertain about what the future holds. So and we've heard from Labour in the election campaign and since they came to government, that everything that they are planning to do is underpinned by growth in the economy. So how does that sit with what we've heard in the last few days?
Yeah, and we're getting quite contradictory messages. We also saw that consumer spending in August was up, you know, really quite strongly. So exactly how people are responding is, I think, a bit uncertain. At the moment, look, I mean, Labour have said they're really focused on growth, and we've seen one or two indications in the right direction there, in particular some of the proposed reforms to planning rules, although, again, some of those could have been better. We've really got very little else in the way of serious detail. They've been talking about this thing called a national wealth fund. We don't know much in the way of details. It doesn't look terribly big. They've talked a lot about green energy, but I think it's important to be clear that green energy and growth are two different things. They're not the same thing. But as I said, one of the first things that Rachel Reeves did was to abandon some of the road and rail building projects, which actually are important for growth. So again, this is something we're going to hear a lot about. I'm sure we're going to hear all of the right noises about focusing on growth. And I think we're going to get something which begins to look like a growth strategy. But that will, I mean, the proof really will be in the sorts of reforms, tax reforms, focus on investment spending, the details of the planning reforms, all of those things, some of which we'll see in the first budget, but which would actually take, quite a lot longer than that to really get a sense of how they're going to do it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Paul. Paul Johnson, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Rachel Reeves will be with us after 8 o'clock. Lots of you getting in touch. Michael's been in touch saying, as a business owner, the rhetoric of gloom and doom from Rachel Reeves is very alarming. She's managed to snuff out a sense of optimism that was beginning to emerge in the summer. This, coupled with extraordinary political naivety surrounding freebies, is extremely concerning. I had hoped that we got rid of ineptness from our politicians. It seems not, says Michael. Do get in touch with your text on this or anything else you hear. 85058.
Coming up, we're going to be hearing from Gloria Allred. She's a lawyer representing some of the victims or those accusing Mohamed Fayed. Story that seems to have just grown and grown and gathered momentum over the weekend. We'll also talk to former Arsenal defender Matt Upson about his old side's 2-2 draw with Manchester City.
And Frank Warren, who was promoting the Dubois side of the Joshua Dubois fight, will join us live as well.
By the way, I should say Rachel Reeves' speech will be live on Adrian's show today. He's in for Naga from 11 o'clock this morning, so he'll take that speech in full at noon. And then, of course, Matt Chorley will be here from 2 o'clock this afternoon. He's live from the conference in Liverpool. He'll have reaction to Rachel Reeves' speech and the winter fuel vote, if there is one. We still don't know if that's going to go ahead. And he'll speak to, among others, the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy. So that's from 2 o'clock this morning here on 5 Live. 16 minutes past 7.
This week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 7.45, Newcastle United travel to AFC Wimbledon in the EFL Cup. And 5 Sports Extra has ball-by-ball coverage of England versus Australia in the third ODI. And tonight from 7, join Mark Chapman for the Monday Night Club.
Evening, welcome along to 5 Live Sports.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
So there was a pretty spicy game in the Men's Premier League yesterday. Manchester City drawing with Arsenal 2-2 in the end. The same result in the WSL and another thrilling 2-2 draw actually between both those sides. Vivian Miedema scoring on her return to the Emirates and her City teammate Jess Park striking with a cracking goal. As for the home side, well, here's what positives the Arsenal boss Jonas Eidevall took from the game.
Team morale, coming back from a difficult situation, really showing that resilience we have in the team and finding a way to get back. That's a real clear positive. Our ability to create some really, really high value chances in the game, I think that's a real positive.
Well, we can speak to the former Manchester City and England goalkeeper Karen Bardsley. Morning, Karen, how are you?
Good morning, I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Actually, I am, as we speak, just looking at Jess Park's goal for Manchester City yesterday. Do you want to start by talking about that?
Yeah, well, at the time, we were all kind of thinking when we were watching it that we didn't know how much she actually knew about it, because obviously she was getting pressed really, really quickly from behind, but she managed to balance herself and get a real quick snapshot, lovely half volley, which she made connection with, and it just absolutely sailed, didn't it, towards the goal and, you know, just kissed the underside of the bar and bounced down, and we were all absolutely elated, you know, with that strike, just because of the nature of the game and kind of where it went at the time. But yeah, no, it was massive for us. She picks up some great spaces at the edge of the area, and just the instinct that she had to kind of recognize that she needed to hit it quickly.
Yeah.
Just kind of pulled the game back for City, and it was a lovely ball in as well. I believe it was Lauren Hemp that played that ball in as well. So yeah, lovely, well worked, finish from Jess, but yeah, She's been outstanding.
She is quite a talent. Let's just reflect on the game more generally. A really thrilling match, wasn't it, all in all?
It was really open. I mean, from a neutral's perspective, I think it was really, really exciting. Lots of goals, lots of transitions, end-to-end stuff, quick pace, lots of tackles, you know, some controversy as well. So it has everything for everyone. But yeah, I think, to be honest, Arsenal were outstanding in that first half. They really overran Man City, particularly in the midfield, made it really difficult for Yui Hasegawa to get on the ball. But, you know, City kind of found their way back into it toward the end of the first half. But then, yeah, the second half had more in store. Again, some controversy with that second equalizing goal for Arsenal, with Katie McCabe kind of chipping over Chloe Kelly on the floor, and a cross by Rosa Kafaji that was finished off by Beth Mead. So, yeah, it had everything for everyone. It was really, really fun to watch, to be honest.
Yeah, and actually probably overall a fair result. And there was, of course, the narrative, the subtext of Vivian Miedema coming back to score against her old team. But she did it in a very dignified way, didn't she?
No, she did, bless her. I think, like, obviously it looked like she was a little bit emotional when she came off in the end. But, yeah, she didn't celebrate when she scored, but it was a lovely display of skill. A little, I mean, obviously the ball fell quite favorably to her, but a bit of flip-flap for a nutmeg for an opportunity on goal and a slight deflection. But, yeah, she's been a fantastic acquisition for Man City. We're lucky to have her.
Yeah, didn't celebrate and was, I think, roundly applauded by the Arsenal fans as well. And some of them even still have her name on the back of their shirts. So she's got so much respect in the women's game, hasn't she?
No, she really is. She's a class act. Obviously, she's been she's a stalwart for Arsenal, and hopefully she will be for Man City as well. But she just brings another level of creativity, but also, like you say, class and dignity on and off the pitch. So, yeah, the club will be grateful to have her.
How much do you think this game tells us about the way the season is going to play out?
I hope it tells us everything. You know, like I said, this game had everything in it. I hope it's going to be really competitive. You know, we've seen some results from around the league as well that have been kind of interesting. So I certainly hope that, you know, the league itself is growing in its competitiveness. There's lots of interest from everywhere. It's attracting all sorts of international talent as well. So the quality is just going to go up and up and up.
And a good crowd there yesterday. It's worth mentioning that actually.
No, it looked like a really great atmosphere. I was up in Manchester watching it, and then I watched the men's game afterwards, so I didn't get a chance to experience it myself. But yeah, playing at those big stadiums, it's, you know, where the women need to be, where they deserve to be. And yeah, it was great to see what looked like a great atmosphere.
Thanks very much, Karen. Nice to talk to you.
My pleasure. Have a great morning.
Yeah, you too. Karen Bardsley, bye, former Man City and England goalkeeper. There's loads more reaction to all the weekend's football, actually, on Five Live Football Daily. In terms of the men's game, we're going to talk to Matt Upson just before 8 with our Monday Breakfast Club. It is 7:22.
Now, the weekly food shop can be a major drain on family finances. That is why supermarkets want customers to believe they're doing all they can to bring prices down. But are their deals and promotions as good as they look? Well, the BBC's Panorama programme has been investigating price match promises where stores like Tesco and Morrison's claim they're selling products for the same amount as discounters like Aldi. Speaking with reporter Michelle Ackerley, the Marquez family from Manchester were asked to do a shop, at Tesco to see if they could find an Aldi price match equivalent.
So the Aldi chicken nuggets have 60% chicken breast in comparison to these Tesco ones, which have 39%.
Wow.
But the same price, definitely not the same quality. Fans of coconut milk? Yeah, sometimes I do a chicken korma. Aldi's coconut extract came in at 40%. And Tesco's coconut extract, 22%. So 78% of that whole can is nothing to do with coconut.
Let's talk to consumer expert Kate Hardcastle. Morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So this is less to do with getting less for your money. That's kind of visible, isn't it? Because we often talk about shrinkflation and, you know, the actual product shrinking or there not being as much of the same thing. But this is different, isn't it? How common is this?
Well, it's becoming more noticeable in supermarkets. And I think it's a melee, really, of marketing and perhaps these misleading pieces that make it very difficult for us as consumers to shop. I think principally, when I contribute to the programme and think about these situations and these families, we're dealing with very time-pressured households that are doing their best to go around and understand what's the best value. They're really trying to make sure they bring that home in terms of nutrition, in terms of affordability. And it just feels it's almost like they're trying to combat this. And the irony for me is, we have our UK grocery stores spending billions on advertising to push a message of loyalty, trustworthy, authenticity. And when these situations occur and these programs happen, I think it's just a whole wake-up call for the consumer in the UK to think, actually, I don't know if I can trust these messages. And that doesn't lead to a good situation for the retailer or us as customers.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you say on the one hand you're price matching, then the consumer will think, oh, it's the same product. And I guess what this panorama has shown in certain cases, it isn't.
And absolutely, why would you not? If you are having something that's clearly in front of you, normally in a bright yellow piece of paper, a piece of cardboard that is a real attractor in store, telling you and reassuring you that you can buy this and don't worry about it. You don't have to be fickle. You don't have to do a multiple shop in multiple retailers. You are getting the same product here. There is no reason that you should have to disbelieve that. And I think this for me is the whole sticking point that absolutely in any research I've ever done, has never been a point where a consumer isn't aware that supermarkets make profit or that that needs to be part of the business mix. Mm. But it's understandable that they would want that profit to feel fair. And when it's constantly different messaging, going back 10, 20 years, those sort of buy one, get one free value offers through to this, which seems to be a mix of, as you mentioned, shrinkflation, what I call kind of mug's eyeful packaging. So where the packaging makes it seem like the product's even larger, then you get it home and look at the weights and measurements and it's a very different story. It just feels almost like you have to go through aisle by aisle, really vigilant, really have your wits about you, when most of us are actually trying to deal with the school run or messages on the phone from other people or just trying to get the job done at the grocery shop. And even online with shopping, there's more information perhaps, but there's an overwhelming amount of products to navigate.
Yeah, and in many ways what we're talking about is mis-selling, aren't we? Is it as simple as that? And if it is that, and it, people aren't being told the whole story, then what is the incentive for supermarkets to change? I mean, what are the penalties for behaving in this way?
Well, any case that's absolute proven mis-selling, of course, needs to be taken into account. I think all supermarkets are very active in marketing messages that perhaps don't offer the full clarity of the situation because it's maybe in the small print.
Yeah, but in other sectors, there would be a penalty for that, wouldn't there? You know, you could get pulled over the course financially.
Absolutely, and should be. But I think there's a bigger concern down the track for retailers. The consumer's only going to have more information at their fingertips. There's only going to be more information available. There's only going to be more programs made like this where people can watch it, understand what to look for. And the more that situation happens, the more difficult it's going to be for those retailers to do it. And I just think principally, organizations spending billions on trying to be seen as your trustworthy friend that you should be loyal to, that then feature in organization programs like this that say, actually, you have to really aware of what's going on. It's just a complete irony. It doesn't work out.
I completely agree with you, but I guess my overreaching point is, does government need to step in and come down heavy on all of this? Because at the end of the day, you can have investigations and they can say sorry and we'll do better, but we know that they find other ways around this.
I think any consumer should be protected all of the time, be that dynamic pricing, be that concert ticket prices that don't seem fair, be it on your weekly shop. We should not have to suffer the challenges of having to always second, third check everything. We should be in an environment where as consumers, we get a clear language and transparency. And I've been on that campaign for a long time, so you'll hear no argument from me.
And just finally, so I'm clear, who holds supermarkets to account?
Oh, there's watchdogs and there's multiple organisations as well that work to hold them to account. And we have many consumer advisors as well, like which really do a good job in terms of the consumer insight. I think the reality is, though, we're time pressured, feel very time poor. And the more challenging these marketing messages, the more difficult it is to really navigate that, because information's there, but it needs to be really quickly absorbed for us to be able to make sure we get the best deal each week.
Thanks for joining us, Kate. Consumer expert Kate Hardcastle. Love your views on this. Do text 85058. Here is a statement from Tesco. They say this. They have a higher proportion of any one ingredient just because there is a higher proportion of any one ingredient in a product. It doesn't necessarily mean it's better quality, and it has clear processes ensuring hundreds of products are comparable with those sold at Aldi. Excuse me. Morrison said it price matches covers over 200 cupboard staples, and it's added a further 70 products and has never implied that it was tens of thousands of products. More on this panorama tonight. Supermarket deals, how good are they? It's on tonight, 8 o'clock, BBC One, and available now on iPlayer.
I wonder if we are getting better at reading labels. All the discussion that there's been recently about processed food and how much stuff that we might not be familiar with goes into these kind of highly processed foods. But I know there's been a lot of chat about it. Whether that actually filters down into people's everyday shopping experience, I don't know. I know pet food, for example. Mm. I was at one of the big pet shops recently and they actually advised me. They said, check out the meat content of anything you're buying.
Yeah.
Because it varies considerably from product to product.
Yeah.
Oh, blimey.
It's a lot on the consumer.
It's another
isn't
thing
it?
To have to do. Another label.
Sorry,
to check.
Fido.
Exactly. Your texts on when you've been marched to the police station or when you've marched your child to the police station. This is after the story that's the most read actually on the BBC News website at the moment. Excuse me, a 14-year-old boy who avoided prosecution because the director of public prosecutions decided the telling off he got from his parents after they took him to the police station was more effective than actually putting him through a court process. Sally in Ware says, when I was 15, I was on a march for education and I climbed the wall of York House in Twickenham. I was grabbed by a police officer who told me to go straight home and he'd deal with me later. That's because the policeman was my dad.
Aha!
I went home. And she doesn't say how then that was kind of finally dealt with. Apparently there is a storyline in The Archers as well where the police take their child to a police station at the moment. So it is a thing. We know that. Tell us what your own experience is, please, on 85058. Right, coming up, Monday Breakfast Club. We're going to be looking back at the weekend's football and in particular at that very tasty match at the Etihad yesterday afternoon. It's 7:30.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will address the Labour conference in Liverpool today for the first time since the party won power. She'll try to inject some optimism into the government's plans after weeks of dire warnings about the state of public finances.
Police records mentioning machetes, swords and so-called zombie knives have doubled over the past 5 years. 32 forces across England and Wales responded to BBC requests, revealing large bladed weapons appeared in more than 14,000 crime logs last year.
Donald Trump has indicated he won't run for the White House again if he loses the presidential election in November. Speaking to US media yesterday, the 78-year-old said that would be it.
And a 14-year-old boy caught up in riots sparked by the Southport stabbings has avoided punishment after police and prosecutors decided the wrath of his parents was sufficient. The Director of Public Prosecution, Stephen Parkinson, says the telling off the child received after being marched to a police station was more effective than taking him through the courts. Just on supermarket labels, Mark makes this point. Very good one, which is what you were kind of alluding to. The piece about supermarket mis-selling included a comment about consumers having more information being presented as a positive thing, which I guess it is. But for me, I'm increasingly finding that I'm having too much information thrown at me every day. I am becoming more of a data analyst than a human being. If anything, I want it all to slow down and have less information to process.
Just be honest. Just tell us what we're buying and don't lie. How about that?
Yeah.
Get me in that meeting. Let's have a look at the weather. Here's Matt's.
Thank you very much, Claire. Good morning, all. Some horrendous conditions out there across parts of England this morning. There's some passing heavy downpours just about anywhere, but the most persistent rain is across parts of central southern England, especially the home counties through to Oxfordshire, Gloucestershire, down across Somerset. Now, these are the areas where we could see around a month's worth of rain fall before the day is out, if not a little bit more. So there could be some further flooding around as we go through the day. There'll be a few spots that stay dry, especially towards the southwest, Northumbria, Northumberland as well. Wales, a few downpours around, some avoid them altogether. Scotland, Northern Ireland, largely dry and cloudy. Best the sunshine in western Scotland, but there will be some rain in the far north later. Temperatures of around 12 to 20 degrees.
How?
Do you want to try that again?
Sorry, it's because I was reading a message from Katie that started with the word who, and my brain couldn't cope with talking and reading at the same time.
Fair
so
enough.
What I meant to say was, how is the travel looking, Orna?
Howdy.
Quite come out like
yeah.
that.
It's not great. It's because we've got localised flooding everywhere. Heavy rains caused it. Lots of motorway closures this morning. So, very quickly, M56 still closed eastbound. Junction 12 at Runcorn, queues to 14 at Helsby near Chester as well. Then you've got the M6, couple of lanes closed. Shed Load, 24, Ashton in Makerfield. Queues backing up on that northbound side. Southbound on the M6, 14 at Stafford North, partly blocked after an accident. M40, long delay still there at Junction 10 at Brackley, heading south where the accident was. M1 M1 all open, but delays. Southbound at 27 Hucknall. Then the A1M. One lane still closed for an accident. 3 at St Albans northbound. QE2 bridge queue still there on the M25 clockwise after the earlier problem on the other side. And the M3 heading south. One lane down for an accident. 3 at Lightwater. With the M2, all traffic at a stand now at Junction 3 at Chatham, heading west. Orna Merchant into 5 Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Just before 25 to 8, 5 Live Breakfast, Rachel and Claire with you today. There are many ways and different words we could use to describe...
Should get Max Verstappen to do it, shouldn't we?
Yes, we could use to describe Manchester City's draw with Arsenal yesterday in the Premier League. But we like to give Stephen McInerney the honour. He was a City fan who joined us earlier.
It was hilarious. Honestly, in football, if you can't win graciously, draw comically.
I think he's onto something.
It's a brilliant way to sum it up, isn't it? Tell us what happened.
I mean, it was just ridiculous in so many ways. We had this first half full of needle, full of temper, full of goals, actually. We had 3 goals in the first half. Then Leandro Trossard got sent off, and the second half was just bizarre for 2 teams you would not expect this from. Arsenal producing a back 6, 3 men in front of them, the lowest of low blocks. And then City just not able to break through, find that spark. They still had 24 shots, struggling, I think, for a little bit of creativity. How do they create the shots without the space? Eventually, they broke through in the 98th minute via John Stones, so it ended 2-2. Going back to the first half, though, so Calafiori's equaliser for Arsenal, this was one of the controversial incidents. So Mike Oliver, the referee, called Kyle Walker over to him to try and calm things down on the pitch in the game. Walker then says he wasn't given enough time to get himself back over to his right back position. When Arsenal took the free kick, they'd been awarded quickly and then scored.
You know, we got 22 angry players all screaming at him continuously, but if I went over for my own accord, I kind of say fair enough. But for him to call both captains over and then not let me get back in position, if I was a goalkeeper, does he let me get back in my net? Of course.
So elsewhere, Brighton drew 2-2 with Nottingham Forest yesterday. Both managers sent off late on in that game. It was after Forest player Morgan Gibbs-White had also been shown red. It meant neither of the managers actually spoke to the media after the match. So members of coaching staff kind of wheeled out to take on the responsibilities, which is always quite amusing. Celtic beat Falkirk 5-2, so that means they set up a Scottish League Cup semi-final against Aberdeen. Holders Rangers are going to take on Motherwell. And in the Women's Super League, it was also Arsenal against City yesterday, this time at the Emirates. That also ended 2-2. Viv Miedema scoring a goal, getting an assist for the other on her Arsenal return.
Depressingly, we're talking about Rory McIlroy throwing away another win.
Oh, it's gutting, isn't it? It's quite hard to watch. But this time, much more positive. We'll hear from him in just a second. But it's happened several majors over the last couple of years. This year specifically, though, that hugely painful opportunity lost at the US Open in June. He also led the Irish Open going into the last day and didn't win, and then yesterday fought to get into this 3-way playoff at the PGA Championship at Wentworth, only for American Billy Horschel to win on the second playoff hole with a long range putt.
Over 72 holes, it's really fine margins and little things here and there, but that's the ebbs and flows of a 72 hole golf tournament. And you know, I can't walk away here anything but with positivity about where my game is, how I feel, you know, looking to the last 3 events of the season.
On to F1, Lando Norris certainly feeling positive as well.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix, closes the gap to Verstappen in the Drivers' Championship, and under the lights, the fireworks explode for McLaren and Norris.
So brilliantly, Norris now 52 points, only 52 points, we should say, behind Verstappen, Max Verstappen, with 6 races remaining. Verstappen's not been hugely happy this week, so he got punished by the FIA for swearing in a press conference. He says it could now speed up his exit from the sport, says he doesn't want to deal with things like that. And just finally, in cycling, Belgium's Remco Evenepoel retained his men's world time trial title at the World Championships in Switzerland. Australia's Grace Brown was the winner of the women's elite time trial in her final season as a professional. And it was gold, of course it was, for Britain's Sarah Story in the women's C45 event.
Brilliant news. Katie, thank you very much indeed. 5 Live Breakfast, 21 minutes to 8. The Crown Prosecution Service has said that it twice considered bringing charges against the ex-Harrods owner, Mohamed Fayed, but concluded there was no realistic prospect of a conviction. Police officers presented the CPS with evidence in 2009 and 2015, which our prosecutors looked carefully at, it confirmed. Fresh allegations are being made about the billionaire who died last year at the age of 94. Gloria Allred is part of the team representing 37 of Fayyad's victims.
Individuals are emailing me who have not come forward previously, either to a barrister or attorney or to the public through the media, and they're interested in learning what their rights are. So, yes, there will be more people coming forward. I have no doubt about that.
Over here in the UK, the Crown Prosecution Service twice did not prosecute Al-Fayyad over sex abuse claims. What is your thinking about that? You must have looked into this. I mean, police officers presented evidence to try and get some legal action going. In one case,
reportedly, someone who was underage did report to the police. And yes, they decided not to prosecute, allegedly, after speaking to Mohammed Al-Fayyad, who no doubt denied it. But also that individual has said that she recognized that she had made a mistake of one day on the date that she provided to the police. And so perhaps for that reason, they didn't proceed. If that is the reason, I don't think it should have been the reason they didn't proceed. For issues, matters, especially traumatic matters that happened many years ago, perhaps decades ago, it's not uncommon for a victim to not remember a particular date. So I'll give you an example from a case that I had against Bill Cosby, famous television personality in the United States and in other places around the world. We had a client who alleged that she was 16 years old when Bill Cosby molested her at the Playboy Mansion in Southern California. And she recognized when we just a few weeks before trial or a month before trial or so that she had been mistaken about the date, that it was actually 1 year earlier. She thought, I think, that she was 15. Turns out she was 16. Either way, she was underage. Nevertheless, we went to trial. We gave the truth and explained the mistake to the jury, and we still won the case against Bill Cosby. So exactly when it took place is not necessarily the end of the line, the end of the story. Juries can look at other evidence.
What message do you have then for, I mean, clearly more people have come forward following this documentary, following the press conference you had with alleged victims last week as well. What is your message to people maybe listening to this now?
I think information is empowering to victims. As you probably know, I've dealt with victims of R. Kelly, victims of Harvey Weinstein, victims, 20 victims of Jeffrey Epstein, many accusers of Bill Cosby. So I have a lot of experience with victims who come forward who are in fear of, you know, having their name or the situation be public, but they'd like to know, is there any way they can still assert their rights? And the answer is yes. And that's what we explain to them. We explain the benefits and risks of taking the next step and what the next step is. And then it's up to the victim to decide if she wants to proceed further. For example, the new owners of Harrod at the end of the BBC documentary did say that Harrods failed the victims and they wanted to do the right thing. Well, that's good, because I always say it's never too late to do the right thing. They should be entitled to compensation. For example, many of them went to a medical doctor because sometimes they were the victims of violence by Mohammed Al-Fayyad and they paid for the doctor, or they went to therapists, they paid the therapist. So they should be able to recover those bills and also lost wages. So we're looking forward to a positive outcome. that we think the victims want to obtain justice. We know they do. The next step is to find out what justice is going to look like.
Final question. You're a woman and you've just listed some of the men you have taken on and the victims you've supported down the years. And here we are again with another set of women that nobody knew about until the documentary aired last week. And all of these stories come forward and it just feels like history repeating itself. What do you see as changing here? Anything at all?
Well, what I've seen in the 48 years I practice law and with a focus on women's rights and victims' rights is that there's still many rich, powerful, famous men who are using their status and their form of celebrity to victimize vulnerable victims. And that's the bad news. The good news is that the women, the victims, are now empowered and they're going to seek to know their legal rights, assert their rights, vindicate their rights. In other words, they're not going to live in fear anymore because fear is the weapon that keeps victims silent.
Gloria Allred there. She is part of the team representing 37 of Fayed's victims. Harrods told us this. The current owners say they are utterly appalled by the allegations and that employees who were his victims had been failed, for which they sincerely apologise. And of course, if you have been affected by issues in this story, there is a range of organisations and websites that can offer you advice and support. You can find them listed on the BBC's Action Line website, bbc.co.uk/ActionLine, 7:45.
Now, as we were saying in the news, the number of crimes logged by police which involve reference to swords, machetes or so-called zombie knives has almost doubled in 5 years. A BBC investigation has revealed the figures ahead of a ban on certain weapons which comes into force across England and Wales tomorrow. Our correspondent Dan Johnson is at a mail centre in Slough. Morning, Dan. What are you doing there?
Good morning. Yeah, this is a huge warehouse where all the international mail arriving in the UK is searched, is checked for drugs and for other banned items, but for weapons. So Border Force agents here scan every package and are looking for weapons that are banned, stuff that comes under existing bans. And from tomorrow, they'll have new rules to enforce, particularly targeting zombie knives and machetes. We're talking about large blades over 8 inches long. They have to have certain characteristics to come under this new ban. It's a bit complicated about what is actually banned and what isn't. There is a huge issue for Border Force, for the police, for all sorts of agencies and authorities trying to tackle the enormous problem of knife crime. And if we look at the figures that we obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, 32 police forces across England and Wales released data from their crime logs, which suggests they are dealing with twice as many of those large weapons, swords, machetes, zombie knives, as they were 5 years ago. It's around 14,000 for last year. Not every force replied, but it is pretty good data. We don't know that all of those are specific weapons, but those are references to those weapons in the police crime data. It suggests that the number of large weapons, zombie knives particularly, has increased a lot over the last few years, and that's despite previous attempts to try to ban these weapons. And those bans will go further with the new law that comes into place tomorrow. It means new rules that the Border Force agents here will have to apply.
And how, so you're there at the mail centre, what kind of proportion of these knives are being sent to almost to personal addresses, are being ordered from overseas? Do we have any idea?
Yes, a lot of it. It does sound like a problem that exists on the streets, and I've spoken to young people who are carrying weapons and say they've got them from other people, but it is also a huge problem online and then being delivered through the post, and that is something that the police really want to focus on. I've spoken to senior police officers who say their main concern now is how freely available these weapons are from certain social media apps and from certain websites who are willing to sell enormous weapons, very dangerous machetes and zombie knives and swords quite freely with only the very minimal checks. They're supposed to check at least that the person buying is over 18, but we know there are many instances where teenagers younger than that have been able to use fake ID, have been able to get hold of these weapons and have had them delivered in the post. I spoke to a young man last week who was handing in a machete as part of the surrender, the amnesty that's been running for the last month, who said, I bought one of these huge machetes. It was about 50, 60, maybe 70 centimetres long. He said, I bought one online for £16. It was delivered in a few days, and he actually received two when he'd only ordered one. It was almost a buy one, get one free with a referral code for friends. So you see how people are being encouraged into buying more and more serious weaponry. That is the sort of thing that the government, the authorities, are trying to crack down on, but it's not the first time they've banned these weapons. And you'd be astonished at what is still allowed, what the Border Force agents here retrieve from packages, but then doesn't fall within the remit of the ban, the specification, and they have to repackage and send on. It's something they do with a great deal of dismay because they worry how that weapon will be used in future.
Many thanks. Dan Johnson talking to us from that mail centre there in Slough, where they're checking for these kinds of banned weapons. It's 7:49.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's Five Live Breakfast, just shy of 10 minutes to 8. Let's talk about this 14-year-old who was involved in the UK riots back in July and August, has avoided punishment from police and prosecutors. This is the reason why. The head of the Crown Prosecution Service, Stephen Parkinson, said the wrath the child faced from his parents was much more effective than anything the criminal justice system could deliver. Catherine Hill is a parenting expert and director of Care for the Family. Morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Claire.
I mean, it's good to know this kid's being disciplined, but lots of people asking questions as to whether this, just because you've got parents who are going to read you the riot act, whether you should actually, you know, get away, in a sense, with it in the way that this child has.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think, well, number one, boundaries are about security in the home. They're not about discipline. And so I think these parents have got it right in that, you know, setting rules is only half the equation, but it's as important is to follow through when they're crossed. And I imagine, we don't know the situation in detail, but I imagine the judge is required to take all the circumstances of the case into account. And so in this case, felt the parents had done what they needed to do and put those boundaries in place and kept to them, which is what we want for our children as they grow up.
I guess what it depends on is whether you could find another minor in the same situation who didn't have parents who reacted in this way and therefore had a different outcome. I mean, that wouldn't be right, would it?
I know. And I, you would hope that if a judge, the judge is required, I used to be a family lawyer, so I had a little bit of experience of this. And the judge needs to take into account all the circumstances of the case. So if it was a vulnerable family, you would hope that there would be support put in place as well. Obviously, no guarantees. But bottom line is it's the home where these lessons are learned.
It's, as you say, it's all context, though, isn't it? Because it's one thing saying, right, we're going to take you to the police station and, you know, you're going to answer for your actions. But how else should the parents handle this? Because obviously they're taking that bit of it seriously. But should they be supportive as well? What is your advice?
Well, Care for the Family, and actually in research, says there's three styles of parenting. So in brief, authoritarian, which is like the sergeant major, loads of rules, all enforced. Permissive, anything goes. And then the one that we want to aim for is assertive. And that's as few rules as possible about the things that really matter, but in the context of loving relationships. So that's the key. So when the child has come back from the court, or whatever the situation is, when a boundary has been crossed and the consequence learnt, because that's what this is all about, that there are consequences to our actions, then actually for the family to be there to support, to pick up the pieces is really, really important. It's about how we do that.
As you know, though, former lawyer, law is all about precedent, though, isn't it? And if people kind of get wind of this and think, oh, well, actually, all I've got to do is show that I've taken this seriously and maybe, you know, my child can get off or get a more lenient treatment in the eyes of the legal system. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I think obviously that wouldn't be the best line of approach, but I am concerned that parents put consequences in place in the home because, you know, it's not going to be that they're just late for their paper round. It will be a job interview. It's not just that you know, they haven't got enough money to pay for the cinema, it'll be their mortgage. And it's not a chocolate bar they've nicked from the shop now, it's something much more serious. So that is, I think, primarily where we begin, is really making sure that those rules are in place and that then we act on them, or that they learn from natural consequences, because that's life. That's what happens in life. And our goal is to bring them up as responsible adults, not just managing, as we manage this thing. There's a bigger picture.
Good to talk to you, Catherine. Thank you for joining us. Catherine Hill there, parenting expert and director of Care for the Family. Your views welcome. 85058.
Five Live Breakfast.
The Monday Breakfast Club.
Time for us to look back at the weekend's action in the Premier League with former Arsenal defender Matt Upson. Morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm all right, Rachel. Thank you very much. How are you?
Let's, as ever, kick off with your hero and your villain from the weekend. Do you want to start with your hero?
Yes. It's pretty clear for me who the hero of the weekend was. That has to be Erling Haaland. No doubt in my mind, what he's achieved in 100 games, 105 matches, 100 goals in 105 matches is just, it's off the charts. So he's my hero.
It's insane, isn't it? I'm going to come back on that, because Andy in Derby does not agree with you, but I'll come back to that in a moment. Okay. And your villain for the weekend?
Always a little bit harder to find, but I just think West Ham is such a bad start. Julian Lopetegui, their manager, had a bad day. Team selection, played Alvarez in at centre-back. They looked really kind of a little bit unstable and not very well balanced. So he is my villain for the weekend.
That's fair enough, actually. And we'll talk about that incredible game at the Etihad yesterday. But how much pressure do you think Lopetegui's under at the moment at West Ham?
Yeah, no, I think it's tough. You know, I spent quite a long time playing for that club, played in that fixture against Chelsea, and it means a lot to the fans. It's a big rivalry, and to be rolled over at home as easily as what they did at this stage with only one win this season and three losses. I think, you know, you're a new manager, you're always finding your feet, but, you know, you've got to kind of get that done a little bit quicker. They need to turn the results around a bit.
Well, let's dissect that thrilling 2-2 draw at the Etihad then. It was a classic, like Fergie Wenger vibes there, back to those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's great rivalry now, isn't it? Both teams, huge respect, managers, big respect for each other. And the game actually probably delivered a bit more than what, you know, we've seen previously, with it being a little bit dull in terms of action. This one, for me, had plenty of real top-end action, excitement, obviously controversy as well, which we may talk about. But Arsenal were a little bit hard done by, I feel.
Well, let's talk about the controversy. Phil McNulty, I thought, put it brilliantly. He said, Arsenal were brilliantly organised and brave in their performance, but it was laced with high levels of gamesmanship. Do you agree?
Yes. I think that they got to a point where they had to. You know, you have a strategy, you want to get a result. You're within the regulations, you would say. Some would say you're bending those. But I think that they, you know, to get that point and to nearly hang on for the win against this team at home with their home record just shows you, you know, the lengths and the distance they pushed themselves, and they had to do certain things in order to make that happen. And I think they kind of managed the game really well.
Katie's here with us as well. John Stones was not happy at the end, was he?
No, Matt, he was calling it. He was asked if Arsenal had mastered the dark arts, and he said, I'm not sure. Yeah. He would say they have mastered them. I wanted to ask you about the Trossard incident, though, where he gets sent off just before half time, and it looked like Mikel Arteta was kind of remonstrating that he felt that the whistle should have gone. It was in stoppage time in that first half. But the issue was that he kicked the ball away, which Arsenal have seen happen with Declan Rice only a couple of games ago. But a lot of people are saying, well, actually, it looked like he kind of was trying to pull out of that kick because he had heard the whistle.
I agree. I think interpretation is difficult at the time, and I understand the law. And when it's an intentional, the Declan Rice one, he intentionally tries to pop. He knows in his mind he's made a decision and I'm going to try and delay the restart. Trossard wasn't that situation for me. It was a player that, okay, had fouled. You're then in the moment, you're running towards the ball, you've heard the whistle, and sometimes you're in that zone. And he did partially pull out of kicking the ball away. So I don't think it was an intentional thing to do to delay the restart. So I think that referees getting that right on the pitch in that moment is quite a difficult interpretation. The Doku one, I think, was a deliberate way of kicking the ball away in the first half, and that went unpunished. So I think from Arsenal's perspective, to have two this season that have then ended up in dropping 2 points in both games for the same, being punished for the same thing. One of them, like I said, I felt was appropriate in terms of the Rice one. I think that's deliberate. But this one, I think, was different.
Well, Michael Oliver getting stick from both sides, wasn't he, yesterday? Andy in Derby then says this: I don't want to sound miserable, but how come Haaland isn't punished for the last few minutes of the game? He threw the ball at the back of Gabriel's head and then from the kickoff launched himself at full velocity into Partey, like a forward getting to a fullback in rugby under a high ball. I like that. Both were dangerous. Both will be played out in junior football all over the country. But because he's portrayed as this giant cartoonish ogre, it's apparently fine.
Well, I don't like the ball at the back of the head. I think that's a disrespect. I don't like that. Charging into somebody when you're hyped and you see that physicality, I think we all quite enjoy seeing that in sport, don't we? Contact sport. It's a little bit over the top, but you can, you know, you can accept that in those kind of matches. But the throwing the ball at the back of the head when you've scored, yeah, I don't like to see that.
Just a quick one then, Matt. And let's just put to one side Man City's legal issues. But how much does this game then tell us about who's ultimately going to take the title this season?
I'm not too sure we're further along in terms of what it says about that. I think it shows that Arsenal have grown so much into a really resilient team. And Manchester City, the way they started the game, Rachel, was just absolutely superb. Yeah. The 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
As we were
minutes
in that case,
played.
Yeah. Matt, thanks so much. Nice to talk to you. That's Matt Abson. Cheers. The Voice
of the UK. This is Five Live Breakfast.
Don't forget you can get loads more on the weekend's games with Five Live's Football Daily Pod on BBC Sounds, and you can hear the Monday Night Club on Five Live tonight as well.
Let's get the news now at 8 o'clock. The Chancellor will promise there will be no return to austerity despite tough decisions on public finances in a speech at the Labour Party conference, which is taking place in Liverpool. Rachel Reeves' address risks being overshadowed by a debate about the decision to cut the winter fuel allowance from many pensioners. She says she wants to make the necessary reforms to stimulate the economy.
Good jobs paying decent wages, vibrant high streets and public services, particularly our National Health Service, that are properly funded through tax receipts. That's the difference that we can make if we can undo the damage. It's 2 years now since Liz Truss's mini budget, which did such damage to our economy. It sent mortgage rates spiralling, it put pensions in peril and it undermined our reputation on the world stage. We are reversing the decline that the Conservatives oversaw and bringing investment back to our country. That's what I'll be setting out in my conference speech today and in my budget.
And we'll be speaking to the Chancellor live at 8:30 this morning.
The Israeli military says it is conducting extensive airstrikes on Hezbollah targets in Lebanon as cross-border attacks between the two sides continue to intensify. Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari has warned Lebanese civilians to move away from areas used by the Iran-backed group for military purposes. At the weekend, Hezbollah struck deep inside Israel, reaching targets in the city of Haifa.
BBC News has learnt that police records of machete, swords and so-called zombie knives have doubled over the past 5 years. 32 police forces across England and Wales released figures showing the large bladed weapons appeared in more than 14,000 crime logs last year, up from 7,000 in 2019. This man handed in knives he owned to the amnesty.
I bought them to protect myself a while ago after I got attacked and kidnapped. I got stabbed 12 times. When I was kidnapped, they had weapons the same size. So I thought, if that ever happens again, those same people, then I need something to combat that, realistically. Yeah, I've got to protect myself, really.
Analysis.